Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of July 6, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, with my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. Let's take a look at space weather from spaceweather.com. So, Mike, what's happening with the sun over the next couple days?
Hi, Jay. As last week, the sun is fairly calm. We are not expecting flares today. And our opportunity for geomagnetic storms is pretty small. There's a 15% chance over the next 2 days of an active condition. But to get to minor or severe, minor is at 5% and severe is at 1%. So it is pretty unlikely we're going to see any kind of notable solar weather affecting the Earth for the next 2 days.
Okay. So we've got a full moon coming up on Thursday. And so that means that the bright moon will probably wash out most of our night sky for observing this week. But this time of year is a good time of the year to observe Scorpius, sometimes called the Orion of summer. And of course, Scorpius refers to its kind of scorpion shape. And sometimes to me, it looks kind of more like a bow and an arrow. I can always kind of pick it out by the kind of arc shape there. And then kind of the bright red star Antares is part of what I call the arrow, but it would be kind of the body of the scorpion if you were looking at it as a scorpion. And so it's kind of the bright red star that often gets confused for Mars in the southern sky this time of year. And I always kind of think of it as the harbinger of the Milky Way, as the Milky Way is usually rises just to the east of Antares, and kind of Antares is just kind of to the western edge of the Milky Way. So if you're in a marginal sky or a washed out sky like with the moon, and you're not absolutely sure where the Milky Way is that you can usually see at least Antares. And so kind of look for the bow and arrow kind of shape in the southern sky. And so that might be, that's kind of our big feature for the week. There in our news, there was a newly discovered space rock that has a new designation, 3I/Atlas, and the letter I stands for interstellar. So we have a visitor from another solar system. And this has only been confirmed with two other objects besides this object in recent years. And the Minor Planet Center, the MPC, confirmed the new designation on July 2nd as 3I Atlas, or Comet C/2025 N1, which stands for Comet 2025 and N1. And the MPC also said that there's a tentative reports of cometary activity with a marginal coma and a short three arc second tail. So it's official. We currently are being visited by what appears to be a comet from another solar system. And the reason that we know that this is an interstellar object rather than a typical comet is that when we plotted the path, it has a hyperbolic path that will bring it into our solar system, and it will actually pass between the orbits of the Earth and Mars. And that is opposed to an elliptical path that a normal comet would have. And so when we kind of look at Oort cloud comets, we can plot their path and basically get an ellipse and with an elliptical path, that means that it will return to our solar system because it's a closed circle. Whereas a hyperbolic path is basically this is going to be a one-time visitor to our solar system. And so, in speaking about its path going to be passing between Earth and Mars, let's talk about Mars today. And today, Mike and I want to discuss the challenges of going to Mars. So, Mike, why don't you start us off with some thoughts on Mars, just in general?
Yeah, it's many people will say it's the closest, most habitable planet, and it is really not habitable in any meaningful sense of the word. A human being would die in as long as it takes to suffocate on the surface. There's no liquid water that we are aware of. There does appear to be frozen water available. And so, the plans, and people have been talking about a Mars mission for decades now. As we were getting ready for this podcast, you mentioned the Mars Society, and that's an organization that was formed in the 90s to advance missions to Mars. And I certainly think that, from a scientific and exploration standpoint, it could be an interesting project. Anybody who's paid any attention knows that SpaceX has been focused on Mars as their purpose. The reason why SpaceX exists is because Elon Musk believes that humanity needs a backup planet and a backup strategy in case something happens to the Earth. And he has intention of, founding a colony of 1 million people on Mars by 2050. And,
yes. Well, go ahead.
He often overpromises things. He believed we in 2020 that we would have a crewed mission on Mars already. He planned to launch something in 2024, which, had we launched in late 2024, with a 6-7 month time travel, we would have humans on Mars today. Obviously, that hasn't happened.
Yeah, and so, there's a lot of validity, I think, to the eggs in one basket argument. And so, early on, I'd read, Robert Zubrin's The Case for Mars, and which is kind of the landmark book for the Mars Society, talking about the colonization and exploration of Mars. And as far as, that makes a lot of sense when you think that, here we are as a species, we've got molten rock less than a mile below us and a vacuum of space, 100 miles above us that we can't survive in for more or less than 10 seconds. And we're in a timeline between possible asteroid collisions and extinction events. So we are in a fragile position. And so that argument has often been made, let's not have all of our eggs in one basket. So in case, for example, an asteroid slammed into the Earth, is that our species can continue if we had self-sustainable presence on another planet. And so, so that's kind of the argument for it. And, I don't really have a problem with that argument as a long-term goal. But I think that, like you said, is that if we want to be a little bit more realistic and a little bit more pragmatic, I think that some of these Particularly the SpaceX goals are probably not the best use of the funds of our economy. And what do you think about that, Mike?
I'm happy to see the science continue, and I believe that, we will eventually end up with humans at least in orbit around Mars, maybe on the moons, by I think 2050 is maybe a not unrealistic time frame to see, the first crewed missions that enter the Martian orbit. And I don't know if you've watched any of the series For All Mankind on Apple TV, but that's the space race continues in this alternate timeline, and there is, an ongoing race to get to Mars after the moon. And I won't give any spoilers, but just a plug for that series. That's really well done.
I'll just chime in there, and I think like the classic science fiction utopian view of space was that we as mankind, as one person, one entity would be the explorer of Mars. But given the history of rivalry, like as in the For All Mankind series, as and if we talk about kind of split resources, rivalry attempts at Mars, that could be a motivator, or it could be actually something that takes away from the momentum or the ability to get there.
Right. And as a short-term goal, I think the focus on a Mars sample return mission is a good point to sort of pin this on. NASA and the European Space Agency have a plan for three missions. The Perseverance rover, which is currently on Mars, gathering samples, storing samples in tubes to be returned to Earth. And then there are two more missions that are planned that will ultimately return a few rocks, to Earth. And so three missions to Mars to get some rocks back. And rocks are famously less finicky about their environment than people are. They don't need water for the return journey. They don't need oxygen for the return journey. And China also has plans for a Mars sample return mission. They originally thought in 2028 that they could do it in one shot using the Tianwen 3 and the Long March 5 ascent vehicle. They've now revised that plan to looking at two launches to get samples back to Earth, and projected maybe 2031. I do know that the NASA ESA joint mission is way over budget by about $4 billion, and over time they're looking at 2040 as their time to bring back rocks. So the idea that we're going to get people to Mars and back, I mean, I can't imagine a one-way trip. There's some pretty big challenges there, including the fuel that's needed for the return trip. And there's a lot of excitement about the possibility of making fuel on Mars. And it seems to me that, if we're going to send somebody to Mars and bring them back, the first stage is really sending missions to Mars that start refining fuel using automation, and then are able to return using fuel that is made on Mars. And once, that's proven to be a viable strategy, then maybe, sending a person there is not an inhumane sentence of death.
And we've killed so many robots on Mars. It's when we actually look at the number of total missions to Mars and their success rate, It's pretty dismal. So we're probably looking in the order of a 30 to 40% success rate or partial success rate in just sending robotic probes to Mars. So we're not doing too well in just the basic doing robotic exploration. So I think that when you talk about trying to keep people alive and get them there and hopefully back, that is getting less and less practical. And I think that also that earlier on we thought there would be less challenges than there are actually. During the Viking 1 exploration of Mars back in, and that was clear back in 1976, and it was sent back all these pictures that basically kind of made Mars look just like Utah, and people were thinking that, oh yeah, that's not so bad. We could get there, and it had blue skies and red rocks and clouds and it looked pretty inviting. But the reality is that the surface dust is toxic. The atmosphere is unbreathable and toxic. It's mostly carbon dioxide. The air pressure is, near space, a lot nearer space than it would be, the air pressure would be closer to space than any place on Earth, including, the top of Mount Everest. And we've had trouble with dust storms killing our machinery. And so, if dust storms can kill a machine, and that machine is doing life support, the chances of actually surviving on Mars are pretty slim. And so there, conditions are a lot harsher than I think that we initially thought of. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. And the other piece in terms of those conditions are the, the lack of magnetosphere and atmospheric protection from solar radiation, and the need to basically, dig into lava tubes or construct in lava tubes. Basically, this civilization is going to be probably mostly underground, and you have to wonder why our backup plan, for the Earth's surface becoming uninhabitable doesn't involve just, digging underground. I mean, humans have weathered out ice ages in caves, and some of which were hand dug in soft, tufa. Mm-hmm.
And we always talk about lava tubes on, both the moon and Mars, and how many lava tubes have you seen on Earth? And although there are some here, actually, rather close to my location here in northern New Mexico, but lava tubes on Earth, it may be as practical as lava tubes on another body.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think that the prospects for the next 10 years are, let's get some rocks back. Let's return some samples, see if Starship will eventually fly without exploding, and complete a mission. I mean, granted, some of those explosions were, flight termination by design, but it does not have a great track record, and that system is our, sort of number one hope for a Mars mission today, a crewed Mars mission. And it just is apparent. The last one blew up during refueling or during fueling on the pad. And there's not another one currently on the calendar this year. I mean, I won't be surprised if they pull one off. But and then there's Blue Origin. We didn't really mention that, but the New Glenn is going to be our next from the US mission to Mars, with some the NASA ESCAPADE mission, I believe it is, which will study Mars magnetosphere. And you know that they've slipped on their timeline for launch, and they're like, well, this is such a big rocket, we have plenty of fuel, we'll just take the long route. And it looks like they're gonna launch at the worst possible window for time to Mars. They're now talking about September or October. Well, November is about the longest journey to Mars you can make. When we're talking the difference of 3 months, if you get an optimal transfer window, it's a 6 month one-way trip. But if you don't, you're looking at more like 9 months. And it seems like Blue Origin has just decided, the heck with it, we'll launch when we launch. We have plenty of fuel. It doesn't matter if we take an extra 3 months to get there. Which, for instruments, okay, I suppose, I suppose. Why not?
And kind of getting back to the eggs in one basket thing, and is there's also a case to be made for the moon, and the moon is not that much less habitable, at least at the southern pole, with the amount of water that they're starting to discover there, than Mars. And the moon is a lot more accessible, and it actually is a little bit protected from radiation by our the Earth. And if you're going to live underground, you might as well, and that would satisfy the eggs in one basket thing, is if an asteroid hit the Earth, there's probably it wouldn't take out the moon at the same time. And it might be, if we had a sustainable, self-sustainable colony on the moon, if they wanted to. If there was a catastrophic, extinction event on Earth, and that's the Moon Society would be able to get back to Earth and recolonize a far more, hospitable planet than it would be for Mars. And so, just again talking kind of in that long-term scientific argument about the eggs in one basket thing.
Yeah, I agree 100% on that point.
And again, the technological challenges is certainly there, and the other than the eggs and one basket argument, there's no real argument, I would say, other than the glamour of exploration, as to why we should send, our living, breathing bags of water to a planet rather than just continue with more sophisticated robotic exploration.
That's right. Now, robots can do just about anything a human can do. I think, maybe the one piece that strikes me is just the excitement of it, that it's the sort of thing that you get an eyewitness account back from, the first man on the moon, the first person on Mars. Generates a kind of interest and enthusiasm that probably inspires, kids to go into the field. And so that's something that's about the only benefit that I see a human bringing in scientific terms, that we don't get
Yeah, and also, of course, and another kind of fly in the soup has been that these massive cuts to the scientific budget, space budget of NASA by the current administration, And so this is one of the other things that these all these kind of proposed and future missions to Mars, and a lot of the research that's going on is being curtailed just for the lack of funding.
Yeah, which is kind of funny when you consider that our President Trump did, in fact, pledge that we would, you know, send people to Mars, you know, in his term. It was part of his inauguration speech. And then within months, you know, the agency is being attacked. Obviously, you know, he was taking a cue from Elon Musk. And I'm sure that was in his speech because Elon had sold him on it.
Yeah, and so this is, I don't want to get too deep into politics here, but I think that, you know, kind of the reason that Elon Musk was wanting to do a lot of the budget cutting with the Doge thing was it so that he could get more funding for his, you know, his, this is his holy grail. This is his, you know, reason for being. It's the Mars thing is the one thing that he, that Elon wants to do in his life that is dry, you know, is what is driving him. And so I think that, you know, he was basically robbing Peter to pay Paul just to get more money toward, you know, this, the whole idea of Mars.
Yeah, that seems plausible to me.
And so anyway, so in the long term, what do you think that our, you know, our best path forward is? And, you know, and what, in your opinion, what do you think we should do about Mars?
Yeah, I think that the Mars sample return mission is a great mission, and that's clearly it's going to take a lot of money and effort, and you know, and maybe the Chinese will beat us to it. If so, great for them. I'd be excited to see samples return. Of course, it won't be the first material from Mars on Earth. We have, you know, meteorites that are almost certainly of Martian origin. And there are, you know, of course, also concerns about, and this is something we haven't really talked about yet, but there are concerns of, you know, could we bring back something, a microbe, you know, that, I mean, that would be the exciting, you know, find of a century, to find evidence of life on Mars. I think that's what everybody's kind of secretly hoping for, or not so secretly hoping for. But conversely, you know, if we, once we start sending people to Mars, it seems inevitable that that surface is going to be contaminated, and it will be very difficult, if you know, to prove that any evidence of life that is found on Mars in the future wasn't inadvertently hitchhiked, you know, on a mission with a colony. And so there's an even better argument for, you know, kind of keeping with robots as our primary scientific investigators on the Red Planet.
Yeah, and so yeah, basically preserving it as an unpolluted planet where you know, and yeah, I was also going to, you know, bring that up, is that, you know, whatever that environment is, it is pristine now. And if there's, you know, any life there, which there was a story this week, they were talking about Mars clays and how they could be a potential very good substrate for life on Mars. And so, you know, preserving that is almost, I would think, as important as, you know, getting a person on the moon that could possibly contaminate that and, you know, certainly pollute that environment. And even with our robots, is, you know, we do have protocols, sterilization protocols, before they're sent to Mars. But there's been speculation that maybe those weren't thorough enough. There could be we could have been already introduced something from our planet to the Mars.
Right.
I love those one syllable answers. All right. Why don't we go ahead and wrap up this discussion for this week and let everybody know that if they we want to thank everybody for listening to the podcast and be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you think about our trip to Mars and what you'd like to hear more about or hear less about. And you can also check out our personal websites. Mike's is wildernessvagabonds.com and mine is skylapser.com. The intro music for the podcast is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from a YouTube audio library. From the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky
wishing you all clear skies.